You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Good morning. I'm going to ask my volunteers to take up their positions in the back. I'll give you a cue in just a second, but if you want to head back there and get ready. Before we hear our passage for today, I just want to give you a little bit of context. If anyone has heard our story from John today, they know just one thing, and there are usually a lot of jokes to go along with it. And that is, Jesus turned water into... look, I see some smiles already, right? Well, truth be told, there are a lot more interesting things in this story than just water being turned to wine. That happens every day, right? Look at any vineyard that you see anywhere in the world. Water and sunlight is being turned into wine. But there are some interesting things happening here if you look closely. Number one, why would the lack of wine be any concern whatsoever of Jesus' mother, Mary? Listen to the story here. Why is Mary concerned about it? It begs the question, whose wedding is this? And why was running out of wine any concern of Jesus? And he says that pretty clearly in this story. Some have speculated that this is implying that it was Jesus' wedding. But that also suggests that Jesus wasn't married yet at about 30, which, if he was typical of Jews of his era, he would have already been married years and years ago, because he was an old man at 30. But the steward does talk to the unnamed bridegroom, who might have been in charge of, right, the wine, and it's unclear whether it's Jesus or not. Just give it a listen and see if that wouldn't work. Anyway, then there are the stone water jars. Most of us blow right by their description. But to give us a better sense of the humor in this story, I'd like to give you a visual. If you all would come right on up here, just come on up, with thanks to Paul's Ace Hardware for their help today. Yeah, look at this. Let's just take these. Thank you, thank you. Let's just do this. Let's do this. There we go. How many is that? That's three. Here we go. Ace didn't know they were going to get all this advertisement today. There we go. And let's do one more. Thank you. What do you say? Okay. This is the wine bottle you're familiar with. This is how much wine Jesus made. Six stone jars, 30 gallons apiece, right? This is how much wine we're talking about. Now, does that change your impression of the story? It's supposed to be funny. It's the equivalent of saying, you know, them mosquitoes in Wisconsin are the size of a Buick. Right? It's supposed to be hyperbole. It's not just the quality of the wine that you're going to hear about in the story. It's the quantity, right? Now, there is so much more to this story, but let's give it a listen and talk about it on the other side. And I'll worry later about my agreement with the manager at Ace Hardware, who said that I could return these as long as I returned them full of wine. So.
There was a wedding at Cana in Galilee. The mother of Jesus was there, and Jesus and the disciples had also been invited. When they ran out of wine, since the wine provided for the wedding was all finished, The mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." Jesus said, "Woman, why turn to me? My hour has just not come yet." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." There were 6 stone jars standing there, meant for the oblations that were customary among the Jews. Each could hold 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water," and they filled them to the brim. "Draw some out now," Jesus told them, "and take it to the steward." They did this. The steward tasted the water, and it had turned into wine. Having no idea where it came from, only the servants who had drawn the water knew, the steward called the bridegroom and said, "People generally serve the best wine first and keep the cheaper sort till the guests have had plenty to drink, but you have kept the best till now." Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Let's pray. Loving and gracious Spirit, for these stories that come down to us with words of wisdom for our lives and for the world, we're grateful. May the Spirit work within us this day, that as we consider this story and more, that none of us would leave this place unchanged. We gather as followers of Jesus. Amen. Well, one of the reasons why many people decide to go to the Holy Land is to get their questions about the Bible answered once and for all. Really pressing questions like, does the Bible really mention a Honda? And the answer is yes, when the disciples all left in one accord. That's the response I wanted. All right. In fact, the trip that we're going to leave on tomorrow got its start over 40 years ago when a Methodist pastor saw a strange phenomena occurring. Churches would often give a pastor a trip to the Holy Land as a retirement gift. And then the pastor would come back going, "Oh my gosh, now I get it. For my whole career, I got it completely wrong." All from the simple act of actually seeing the place for oneself. And that's why back in the 4th century, St. Jerome said, 5 Gospels record the life of Jesus. 4 you will find in books, and the one you will find in the land they call holy. Read the 5th Gospel, and the world of the 4 will open to you. Right? Whether it's floating around the Sea of Galilee and realizing that wherever you are on the lake, you can see all 4 shores. It's so small. Or standing at the base of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem and just trying to take in the massive scale of it because it's so huge. Traveling in the Holy Land gives you a different perspective on the Bible. And when confronted by the 30-foot tall concrete walls topped with razor wire separating Bethlehem from the suburbs of Jerusalem, you're given a glimpse of the tension and simmering humanitarian crises that seem to have no end in sight. From the evidence of ancient times right up to now, everywhere you look recalibrates your worldview. It's an amazing experience. I want to give you just a couple of examples that have helped me recalibrate my understanding of the Bible from having been there myself. A little teaser for those of us who are going, and some background info for those of you who are going to be cheering us on as we go. The first one is location, 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 and location and location. What? Let's talk about what we know about the setting of today's reading. Most tourists are taken to the traditional site of Cana. It's called Kefar Cana, and you'll find it right there. It even says that's the one that gets credit on the map. But it's a Franciscan operation, and I do mean operation. And it's not far from Nazareth, and they've got a nice little church there, and lots of cheap wine for sale. The problem is, this site is completely disqualified as the location of the biblical story, as there are no Roman period ruins anywhere around here. Nothing. Its veneration as a holy site didn't get going until sometime in the Middle Ages, right? So closer to us than to Jesus. And then you've got the other Canas. You've got Cana in Lebanon, right up there. You've got Kirbet Cana in Israel. You've got Karm El Rasam in Israel. And you've got Ain Cana in Israel as well. So will the real Cana please stand up? Here we have a conundrum. We have a story in the Bible, but no physical evidence of its location. And in the case of this story, it only appears in the Gospel of John. No mention in the Synoptic Gospels. So, for me, no actual historic site, along with the wedding at Cana story being just unique to John, and I'm more likely to say that this is a parable about Jesus that we don't have to worry about having actually happened. This liberates me from getting all hung up about venerating a place for having been the location of a miracle, and it frees me to ask, okay, why did John tell this story? What's he trying to say about Jesus? Why was it so important that he took the liberty of telling this story the way he did? So, the long and short of it is, we're not going to Kefar Cana. Partially because it's not historical, and partially because it's maintained as a tourist trap. But on the flip side, we are going to a site a few miles away that isn't mentioned in the Bible, but was undoubtedly a place frequented by Jesus. It's called Sepphoris. After being destroyed by the Romans, it was being rebuilt over the whole course of Jesus' early life, and it would have likely been a place for a contractor, that's a better translation of what Joseph was, a tecton in Greek, a contractor like Joseph and his son to get regular work, especially because it was just over the hill from Nazareth. And this is a beautiful archaeological site with mosaics that rival the mosaics in Pompeii. It's a gorgeous place and more likely than any made-up place to have been a place where Jesus walked. The next thing I wanted to mention was archaeology in general. We all know the story of how on the seventh day, Joshua's people marched around Jericho seven times, and after the seventh time, the priests blew the trumpets seven times, and the people shouted, and the walls came a-tumbling down, right? The problem is, at any time Joshua might have been there, Jericho had no walls. At least as far as archaeologists can determine. The nearby ruins of other ancient cities like Hazor and Lachish have clear evidence of a walled city having been destroyed, but not so in Jericho. Jericho is one of the oldest continually inhabited places on the planet, having been a gathering place for humans for nearly 12,000 years. Why? Dependable water source. That's why. But in the mid-1950s, the archaeologist Kathleen Kenyon discovered some interesting evidence. There were Stone Age ruins, there were early bronze and middle bronze ruins, but there were no late bronze ruins, which you all know the late bronze period was 1500 to 1200 BCE, right? Okay, so in other words, nothing in any time possibly connected with Moses and Joshua. Joshua was supposed to have attacked walled cities, according to the Bible, but in 1400 to 1200 BCE, there were no walls. In fact, a recent discovery has shown that by 1400 BCE, Egypt's control of the area was so strong that it didn't even allow the city-states of Cana to have walls. No walls allowed. It also throws a wrench into the whole Moses escaping from Egypt straight into the clutches of Egypt, because Egypt was in charge of Canaan at the time. Jericho would have probably been, in this time period, a small village of mud brick houses. But then what are all these ruins, you might ask? The tell, or the mound, of ancient Jericho is dozens of feet tall. You get up on the top and you look down at a watchtower from the Stone Age. All you have to do is look at the geography of the area. The Jordan River Valley is part of what's called the Syrian-African Rift that runs from Syria all the way to Mozambique in Africa. And from the Sea of Galilee to the Dead Sea is nearly 65 miles of a straight-line fault called the Dead Sea Transform Fault. Two enormous tectonic plates grinding against one another in opposite directions. That's one of the reasons why the Dead Sea is 1,300 feet below sea level. It's the lowest place on earth that you can walk around outside. It's nearly the same distance below sea level as we are above sea level, right here. And guess what that means? Massive earthquakes about every 30 years. The Dead Sea is being dragged down into the bowels of the earth, right? And that creates all kinds of earthquakes and things. So it shouldn't be surprising that archaeologists have discovered that in the early Bronze Age, that's between 2900 and 2100 BCE, there are 17 layers of Jericho. 17 layers. And what they did is they just kept building on top, right? So you could get higher, because it's always better to be higher for defensive purposes or whatever. The ruins of what had once been a village of Jericho must have served as an irresistible backdrop for early storytellers looking for a dramatic setting of the early Israelites. Sitting around the campfire nearby, one of the kids asks, "Hey, Dad, what's that? What are those ruins here?" "Well, son, it was a long time ago, but when Joshua came across with the rest of the people, they destroyed that city." Do you see what I mean? That's how these stories get started. Next thing I wanted to talk about in closing was the getting a feel for the place. Also in Joshua, there's a story of Joshua asking the sun to stand still, right? At least that's the way I learned it. But then something happened to me. Something happened that I will never forget. I was given a chance to stand on the very spot where that story is supposed to have taken place. And there, we read the story, and I saw what I had never seen before, and saw that the ancient church fathers got it wrong. Every modern commentator had gotten it wrong. Rabbis for centuries, millennia, have gotten it wrong. Wesley got it wrong. Even my mentor and friend Jack Spong got it wrong. You should have seen the grin on our professor's face as he saw it dawn on all of us at the same moment. So let me show you. The first thing you need to know is that there are all kinds of examples of the Israelites preferring to fight at night because it keeps the enemy off guard. Consider that they marched all night to attack. Do you see where they marched from Gilgal, the red arrow, over to Gibeon? And then considers Joshua's request. He asks that the sun stand still over Gibeon. Do you see where Gibeon is right there? Let me help you. Here it is. The sun is going to stand still over Gibeon. Huh? Okay. And the moon stands still over Aijalon. Do you see right there? Aijalon is down right there, so the moon is going to be right there. Where's the sun? In the east. What time of day is it? It's morning. Why would Joshua be asking the sun to stand still? Why would he be asking for more daylight when the day has just begun? Because he's not asking for more daylight. He's asking for more darkness. Then consider a storm big enough to have hailstones that kill more soldiers than the Israelites. That's what the story says. What kind of storm would blot out the sun? The plot thickens when you look closely at the Hebrew. The word translated as stand still in our English text is damam. What it literally means is not stand still, but to be silent, to grow dumb. In other words, to stop doing what the sun does, which is shine, to give light, be still. It gets even more maddening when you find out that the Hebrew word translated as go down, as the sun didn't go down, in Hebrew is actually come in or enter, sometimes translated as bow, when you come in and you bow, right? That's the word. It is not go down, which is what appears in our English translation. So look, we'll never know how this story came together. In verse 11, the weapon is great hailstones. In 12 to 14, it's the stopping of the sun so Joshua can finish them off. Some scholars think that verses 12 through 14 might even be the distant memory of an eclipse or a providential timing of other natural events. But whatever it is, the original story is clear. Joshua was asking for more darkness, not more daylight. And standing there on that hilltop, it could not have been more clear. So, standing in the Holy Land, reading these stories, visualizing the scene for yourself, is a surefire way to never look at the Bible the same way again. Ken Wilber says, transformative spirituality, authentic spirituality, is revolutionary. It does not legitimate the world. It breaks the world. It does not console the world. It shatters it. And it does not render the self content. It renders it undone. What does an appreciation of the fifth gospel do for a person? It severely curtails the likelihood of one ever being able to say, my mind is made up. Don't confuse me with the facts. Look, we're going to see a lot of rocks, right? This is the rock where this happened. That's the rock where that happened. There are, if you didn't know, a lot of rocks in the Holy Land. But you never know when being where it all happened will kind of bring you up short, remind you of your humble place in the universe, and move you in profound and unexpected ways. On Christmas Eve in 1985, I had the privilege of being in Bethlehem with a group of 40 seminarians on my first trip with Educational Opportunities. Bethlehem was mayhem. It was so crowded, so filled with armed soldiers and choirs from 18 different countries singing Silent Night at the top of their lungs. I mean, it just, none of it made any sense. So my compatriots and I, several of us, left. And we found ourselves setting off in the dark to walk out into the fields between Bethlehem and Jerusalem, soon to come across a maze of reinforced concrete trenches and bunkers that had been left over from the 67 war. We scrambled up on top of a decaying pillbox, and there we sat in silence as midnight came, taking in the stars, thinking about the significance of this place for humanity, sacred to three of the major world religions, fought over, loved, bled over for millennia. And there we were, such a small part of the story. That was one of those moments for me. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so excited to take this trip and share this amazing part of the world with nearly 30 others. Everyone brings their own expectations and their own experience to the journey. And then the place does the rest. It's not that this place is all that different from any other, but millennia of pilgrims have come, bringing their expectations and their stories, and have injected the place with a sense of mystery and the more. And if you don't watch out, it will change you. Storyteller Megan McKenna talks about stories as change agents. I think the same can be said of this fifth gospel. The fifth gospel isn't interested in information or content. It's interested in shifting your perception of reality, your view of the world. In fact, it's interested in unlearning you so that you can start someplace else. It's not interested in confirmation. It's interested in transformation, in asking, how do you need to be changed? I trust the Spirit will be at work in the coming weeks, opening eyes, shifting perceptions, and transforming not only those on the trip, but by extension, all of us who they then can share the experience with when we get back. One of the things that I'd like to do, as we did on the last trip, is offer a chance for you to send something of yourself on this trip. Last time we went, we collected prayers from everyone here, and you should have in your program a small slip of paper. And I invite you to take that out at this time. And if you have a writing implement, to get that out as well. And I'd like to invite the pilgrims who are going on the trip to come on up here and stand in front of the wine vats. Come on up and just line up right here. One of the things that we're going to do is we're going to visit what's called the Western Wall. If you can imagine where the Dome of the Rock is right there, that golden dome, you can see that is where the temple used to be. And the Western Wall is revered by Jews as being the closest place that they can get to where the temple used to be. And that's why it's a place of prayer. You can see all the people lined up there. And one of the things you do is you take prayers and you place those prayers on a piece of paper, on a slip of paper, and you stick it in a crack in the wall or put it there otherwise for yourself or for others. I told my barber that we were going, and I didn't even have to say a thing. She immediately grabbed a piece of paper. She's a Russian Jew, an immigrant from Russia, and she immediately wrote out a prayer and folded it up. She said, "Would you leave this at the Western Wall?" So we're going to do a blessing of the pilgrims, and I'm going to ask you to write down a prayer on that slip of paper. Then I'm going to send the pilgrims out among you to receive those prayers, and we will leave them right here in the basket. If you don't have time to write it out just right now, feel free to take a moment and write it out and then bring it up yourself and place it in this basket. We'll spread it out among our pilgrims, the different prayers, and we will take them with us to Jerusalem. Stop crying, you're going to make me cry. And so we'll take your prayers with us. So let's be in the spirit of prayer. First, let's just real quick have us introduce our pilgrims. Everybody say who they are. My father-in-law and my mother-in-law.
Natalie Ann Lindsay.
Carol Coates. Sharon Shaw Elrod.
Rick Walker.
Maddie Felton.
Sam Felton.
Judy Hines.
Linda Bowerly.
And we have a number of other people coming to second service, and we have nearly 8 or 10 of us that are already on the way that kind of went to Jerusalem via Africa or some other convenient place. So we're going to join them in Tel Aviv on Tuesday. So let's be in the spirit of prayer. Loving and gracious mystery that is our companion everywhere we go. We ask that your spirit would be upon each of us, that as we head to this place of reverence and history, of story, and of life-changing experiences, that we might be guided, inspired, and moved to open ourselves to new ways of seeing the world and new ways of being followers of Jesus. May we sense the Spirit with us here and now and all along the way as we strive every step to be followers of Jesus. Amen.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information on our faith community or to support this outreach with a donation, be sure to visit us online at www.reachtouchteach.com.